Welcome to the County Conversations Podcast, brought to you by the Florida Association of Counties Institute for County Government, with support from the University of Florida's IFAS. In this podcast, we dive deep into the diverse and dynamic world of Florida's counties with engaging interviews and thought-provoking conversations surrounding the challenges as well as successes of Florida's counties. Each episode brings you firsthand perspectives from county commissioners, government officials, community leaders, and subject matter experts who are shaping the future of our state. We explore a wide range of topics from economic development and public safety to environmental conservation and emerging technologies. Our aim here is to provide a platform for knowledge sharing, collaboration, and inspiration for county officials and residents alike. Whether you're a county commissioner, government professional, or simply interested in understanding the local government landscape, we hope this podcast provides valuable insights and practical takeaways on all things counties.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the County Conversations Podcast. I'm Eric Poole, Director of FACTS Institute for County Government, or as we like to call it, ICG. We are the training and education arm of the association, offering basic and advanced classes in county government, as well as organizational leadership. As a part of our commissioner certification program, we offer electives across several disciplines, including planning and growth management. And recently, we hosted approximately 40 county commissioners in Tallahassee for our core planning class. And to highlight how broad the discipline of planning is, we added an extra day for a field trip to a very unique place in our state called Tall Timbers. And if you go to the Tall Timbers website, you'll see that Tall Timbers is many things. It's an internationally recognized research station for fire-adapted ecosystems. It's a national hub for prescribed fire science. It conducts research on quail habitat. It's one of the largest regional land trusts in the nation. It's a local landowner directly managing 13,000 acres in North Florida. It even advocates for smart growth and promotes sensible community planning. And they take this last issue so seriously, they even employ a full-time environmental land use planner. And he's with me today in Studio 67. His name is Neil Fleckenstein. And Neil is the planning coordinator for Tall Timbers. Neil, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here, Eric.
All right. Glad you made it at 4 o'clock on a Tuesday. Thank you for doing that. So, Neil, let me start by mentioning something that I said to you a few months ago, and that is while we've known each other for about 30 years, dating all the way back to graduate school at FSU, and I know you've extended some invitations for me to come up to Tall Timbers. I'd never visited until we arranged for our group of county commissioners who enrolled in that class to actually go up there. And it was really eye-opening, because I think all of this time I thought Tall Timbers was a place that just did some ecology research, offered land management services, worked with conservation easements. But Tall Timbers is a lot more than that. And before we get into that, why don't we just get a little bit about your background? Like I said, we met in graduate school, but what finally got you up to Tall Timbers?
Yeah, I graduated along with you in 1994, which, yeah, is a very, very long time ago at this point. I worked in emergency management for about 8 years, similar to what you did. And at some point, I just felt like I wanted to do work on things that I actually hoped would happen, as opposed to things that I hope wouldn't happen, like hurricanes, etc. So Tall Timbers was looking for someone to start their land use planning program, kind of recognizing that the more land that we protected in conservation easements, the more we were beginning to affect how communities grow, and then, of course, how communities grow would also affect our conservation lands. So I kind of had that regional perspective, and that was exactly what they were looking for. So I moved over there in 2002. So I've been there now for about 21 years. And that planning and advocacy program has grown quite a bit since then. I started out kind of working on local and regional issues that affected our conservation interests, also on some smart growth work, as you said. And now that's expanded to a lot more advocacy work at the state level in Florida, in Georgia, where we've got a lot of conservation land as well. And then some policy work in Washington as well.
So I kind of mentioned everything from you know, what Tall Timbers, his many things. Can you just go ahead and provide an overview in your own words about Tall Timbers, its mission, primary goals, and really the membership, because I think that's kind of an interesting aspect.
And you did a really nice job kind of summarizing, but it's an organization that's really hard to give an elevator speech about. It doesn't comport well to a 30-second speech between floors 2 and 3. We are a biological research station, and we focus on the ecology of fire-dependent ecosystems in the southeastern United States. But in addition to being a biological research station, with all that entails in terms of working on forestry issues and species, wildlife and species issues, we also have a land conservancy as well. So we're out there doing research on the landscape, especially on fire issues and how fire affects our landscape. We're doing species research, and then we actually take what we use in those two areas and apply it to managing lands in the greater Red Hills region and in the greater Albany region, and then also getting that land permanently protected. So as you said, we're one of the largest regional land trusts in the southeastern United States. We've got about 170,000 acres right now that we've permanently protected, and those are all private lands that have been protected, voluntarily protected by their owners, and we work with them to ensure the proper management of those properties, and they are permanently protected in perpetuity. So those are lands that are never going to be directed, never going to be developed. And the state of Florida does a fabulous job in terms of land conservation on the public side, and this is a component that's increasingly important because we know there's not an infinite amount of money out there to conserve land. We have great public land conservation programs, but this is another aspect or another way that we can conserve these important lands is working with private landowners to permanently protect their lands.
That's a good elevator speech.
it's a long ride up.
So how was it founded, and can you talk about the membership?
Yeah, it was founded in 1958. It had a very long record before then. It was a working hunting property for many years. And the owner of it, Henry Beadle, recognized in the early 1900s that the wildlife population was dramatically declining in the southeastern United States and here in the Red Hills region of North Florida and southwest Georgia. So he and some other landowners brought in an ecologist named Herbert Stoddard to try and figure out what was happening to these wildlife populations, what had changed. And the simple answer is what had changed is landowners, as a result of federal government action, were no longer using prescribed fire on their properties. And by removing fire, they were significantly changing how those properties are managed. All of our lands in the southeastern United States are lands that benefit from the use of prescribed fire. And once we kind of removed that from the land management toolbox, we saw wildlife populations plummeting in here and in other parts of the country. And of course, there are other issues as well. When you remove that prescribed fire from the landscape, you start dealing with wildfire issues as well. And that's another area that we work on. But that really was the genesis of the start of Tall Timbers, because the federal government had basically tried to ban the use of prescribed fire in the country. Mr. Beadle at that point had his own landscape and wanted to found an organization that really wasn't reliant on the government, that could actually study things like prescribed fire and how we manage species and how we manage our forests. But he didn't really want to have government intervention, so it was privately funded and set up as a nonprofit. And we were established in 1958, so it's about 65 years now that we've been in existence. And the mission has grown quite a bit since then. At this point, we have about 140 employees that work at Tall Timbers. A lot of them are here in North Florida, but we're kind of also spread out in areas across the southeastern coastal plain that we're working on in terms of restoration of species like bobwhite quail across those landscapes, and also working on trying to bring prescribed fire back to those landscapes as well. So that's allowed us to kind of grow from our base in North Florida and southwest Georgia and now we're working in probably 8 or 9 states in the southeastern United States.
So you said historically, well, the federal government had banned using fire.
In the early 1900s, yeah.
But was there some science and research behind that? I mean, were they doing prescribed burning anywhere, or was that something that Beadle had his property?
That was really the result of the lack of understanding of the importance of fire for ecosystem management. Of course, they didn't call it ecosystem management, you know, in the 1900s. But when you read the work of Herbert Stoddard and some of his work from the 1930s, basically what he was describing, you know, almost 100 years ago at this point, is a holistic system of managing our ecosystems, just way, way ahead of his time. And I think that kind of the heavy hand of, at that point, the federal government, in terms of trying to discourage the use of prescribed fire, was really something that was very impactful to Mr. Beadle and led him ultimately to devote or to provide basically his entire property and an endowment to start Tall Timbers off. And as I said, that was in the late 1950s, and we've kind of really grown from that. Now, of course, we've learned so much more about how we manage landscapes now, and you know, one of the most supportive entities of government is the federal government in terms of the use of prescribed fire, right? And we're trying to deal with wildfire issues every year in the far west, and of course, our federal partners and our state partners now are some of our closest. Cooperating organizations. Tall Timbers actually hosts the Federal Prescribed Fire Training Center, is based in Tallahassee at Tall Timbers, which, you know, is a bit ironic given the founding of our organization, you know, 60-something years ago.
So can we talk about what Florida's doing it right in terms of using prescribed burning in contrast to places like California, which I guess are just catching up, right? So you host some of them out here.
Exactly. But so we with the Prescribed Fire Training Center, basically any federal employee who, as part of their job, uses prescribed fire, they'll come through Tall Timbers to attend the Prescribed Fire Training Center. So basically all federal employees from all agencies that are using fire on the landscape or coming through Tall Timbers to learn. Florida leads the nation every year in the use of prescribed fire from an acreage perspective. Every year, the state of Florida is number one. Georgia is a close second, and there's really no one else that competes with the use of fire like Florida and Georgia do. We have individual counties in the state of Florida that burn more acreage in prescribed burns than the state of California. If you look at the top 10 counties in terms of acreage burned, 9 of them are in the state of Florida, and the 10th is just across the border in Thomas County, Georgia. So we're kind of the epicenter of the use of wise prescribed fire for ecosystem management, for species management, but also importantly for wildfire mitigation. And the West, as you said, is beginning to catch up. Obviously, I think pretty much everybody when the summer comes, you turn on, you know, the news and you kind of see, okay, you know, maybe Colorado is on fire or California is on fire, Washington State, Oregon, Montana, etc. And they're really trying to catch up from decades and decades of not utilizing fire as a management tool out there. But it's a challenge to catch up because now you've got forests that have grown for many, many decades without the use of fire, and it's a lot more expensive to go in and try and manage those forests compared to like in Florida where we're burning, you know, a landscape might burn every 18 months to 2 years, hardly any fuel on that landscape. If you do have a lightning strike, you know, there's relatively little fuel for it to burn. You just don't see entire cities in Florida burned to the ground like we have in other parts of the country.
You and I talked about this before, I think, back in 1998. I kind of mark a lot of those years by how many, you know, the named hurricanes. But in 1998, I remember there were floods, tornadoes, hurricanes. But then approaching around April, May, the whole state basically caught on fire with oh my goodness, what's the place over in near St. Augustine? Starts with a palm.
I forget off the top of my
head. I forgot too, yeah. But a lot of residential properties were burnt. Do you know the background of that? I think I may have asked Jim Carls this question casually, but what was so unique in 98 that you had fires everywhere?
That's actually, Jim Carls is the perfect person to ask that question of, and I'd actually like to know a little more of the origin of it myself. I know it was record-setting from a drought perspective, which obviously, you know, plays an important role into that issue. I don't know if we were in a cycle where we weren't using fire as much as we were during other periods. I do know that two of the counties in Florida that were least affected were Leon County and Jefferson County, which are two of the counties in the Red Hills that, again, you know, utilize prescribed fire on a rigorous basis to manage those large private landscapes that we work with. So even during that era, you know, you saw less of an impact on those areas that routinely burn. But I'm not sure if there were some other intervening factors as well in terms of maybe the state not burning as much or the feds not burning as much as they otherwise would. I do know that there's been so much more emphasis in the last 20 years, at least in the Southeast, on the utilization of prescribed fire, both from ecosystem management, because it's necessary. These are the forest lands we're working on are lands that require frequent fire. You know, 500 years ago, those were lightning strike fires. And those fires, you know, they would come on a very regular basis. You know, we've done a lot of work on tree rings, so we know how frequently those return intervals are for prescribed fire. But when you would have a lightning strike fire, you didn't have roads and parking lots and fire departments to, you know, to put out those fires. So you had very low intensity fires sweeping across the landscape. Obviously, once you start getting lands developed a lot, that's an impediment to lightning strike fires, which is fine. But we kind of have to replace that with the use of prescribed fire. So we have Tall Timbers has been a strong advocate for the use of prescribed fire, again, for ecosystem management, but also for wildfire mitigation. And now we're seeing, we work very closely now with our partners out west, trying to kind of get them on board with what we're doing. I was talking with our research director recently, and he's been on the governor's task force in California dealing with the wildfires. And his perspective was really in the last two or three years, they've made greater strides from a policy perspective at the state level than they have in the previous 50 years. So they've actually established some mitigation dollars that are out there to encourage landowners, you know, to burn. They've established some insurance liability protections to protect landowners who are using prescribed fire wisely. So they're definitely catching on and catching up, but they've got this long history they have to deal with of, you know, forests that really haven't been maintained, you know, with fire, and that's gonna be a challenge for them for decades to come.
So why is that? Why are we so much further ahead than they are?
Yeah, I think it's you know, the land managers that I've worked with, you know, kind of joke about it, that just culturally it's been so much more accepted in the southeastern United States, especially in North Florida, Southwest Georgia, where we've recognized for, you know, 100 years now that these lands need prescribed fire. And the managers of large landscapes in Florida have understood that for a long time too. So culturally, we accept it more. If you're in the Red Hills, in Leon County, Jefferson County, Madison County, you cross the border into Thomas and Grady counties. If it's February, March, or April, and a landowner has got a prescribed burn in his property, no one calls the fire department. You know, they understand that's not a wildfire, that's a prescribed fire. So, and that's not the case in other states. You know, it's a shock when you see, you know, fire on a landscape. But because we've burned on such a regular basis, you know, we're not talking about, you know, the images you have in your head of a wildfire. We're talking about a very, very low intensity, you know, prescribed fire that's taking care of the little bit of fuel that's out there. And, you know, our land managers and our prescribed burners at Tall Timbers, you know, they're putting fire on the ground and they're just walking through the area that they burn because there's relatively little fuel there. And of course, when we brought the Florida Association Counties out there, you know, y'all saw the same thing too.
It's amazing.
You know, it's you burn an area, 10 minutes later it's out, and of course you come back 4 days later and you've got green sprouts coming out. And so again, it's just, there's that long tradition of the use of fire here. We've also been exceptionally progressive in terms of legislation to protect prescribed burners in Florida from a liability perspective, and having those legal protections for certified burners has been integral. And that's something that really other states are beginning to catch up, but you know, Florida and Georgia again have led the country in that for many years. So having that legal protection has really helped. Having that culture of burning has helped. And then having the personnel and managers who've grown up with it, you know, frankly, their whole lives. We've got land managers that we work with, and we're working with, you know, second and third generation land managers, you know, who learned from their parents and their great-grandparents. And again, that's, you know, you don't have that in other parts of the country. So we're extremely blessed in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed to me in California, if you were trying to implement something, and I know they're going to try, but the public is so scared of fire. So, and you, I mean, there are real boundaries of this urban wildland interface, right? But
yes.
Out in California, it looks like they're just embedded, right?
They're embedded.
Right on top of it.
Yeah. And, you know, we did benefit from having strong growth management in Florida for a period. That's changed more recently, but we did have strong growth management that really helped in terms of, to a certain extent, containing urban areas and allowing kind of those rural areas to you know, to not be developed. That helped. When you see that extensive urban-suburban interface with the rural areas, and you've got areas that haven't burned in forever that are fire prone, and now we've got million-dollar houses all throughout them, it's a really bad recipe. A lot of those areas, from what I've read, it's almost going to take, you know, having a wildfire in those areas and almost sort of resetting things, because you really just can't go out in an area that hasn't been burned in 40 or 50 years and, you know, go out with a drip torch and start a prescribed fire. You're going to start a wildfire. So it's in some of those areas, you know, they're reclaiming them. They're getting fire on the ground. It's much more expensive on the front side, you know, having to go in and do some selective thinning and using a lot of mechanical equipment. But in some areas where we are seeing these, unfortunately, catastrophic wildfires, that is kind of helping to reset the system. That's maybe the one small redeeming positive. And once that happens, then you can kind of get them on a regular cycle for prescribed fire. And that cycle can change, of course, you know, depending upon the area. Our areas in the Red Hills, those areas, the return interval for fire in our area is about every 18 months to 2 years. It might be a little longer in other areas of the country, but if they do get reset, you know, then there's the opportunity to go in and start managing them proactively with fire. So that's maybe the one redeeming aspect of that.
Yeah, I mean, you almost contrast that in Florida with, you know, a hurricane, and, well, it wipes out 500 to 1,000 properties. And so what do? Do you build back? Do you have some sort of post-disaster redevelopment plan to build back better? Do you consolidate lots?
Exactly.
It's not a exact parallel, but it's
pretty good. And yeah, I mean, you absolutely hate to see that happen. But if it does, then you need to figure out, you know, how can we do a better job of building back better? There might be some areas where we really don't want to encourage, you know, growth and development again. Or if we're going to do it, you know, in those western areas, they need to be fire-wise communities and developed with all the principles and practices to kind of mitigate the potential impacts there. So it's a shame, but that's the extent we've gotten to, where we've got, you know, areas throughout primarily the Western United States, not exclusively, but primarily in the Western United States, that, you know, now are incredibly vulnerable. They, if they haven't had a wildfire, and we're entering a time now with, you know, increasing temperatures and drier conditions, and a lot of development in that wildland urban interface, that's just a very dangerous set of circumstances. And again, in Florida, just to contrast it, we've done a much better job, at least in that regard, in terms of policies to support prescribed fire. We've got a great Forest Service. You know, Florida Forest Service does an outstanding job of managing with fire, and of course, you know, dealing with wildfire when it does happen. But it's just a different scale. When we have something like that happen here, it's not entire towns, you know, burning to the ground like we unfortunately have seen in other parts of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most extreme fire event that I'm aware of, at least, was the one over in Bay County post-Michael, maybe, I don't know, 18 months ago. But they were able to contain that over time. But, you know, I don't track this on a daily basis, but I don't know of any other fire event in Florida that, you know, really impacted a number of, you know, residential or non-residential structures.
Yeah, there have been a couple of instances where we have had prescribed fires that have escaped, and that I think is one of the challenges is, you know, the perception, if you're not familiar with the use of prescribed fire, that that's a really dangerous tool. The reality is it's far less than 1% of prescribed fires that, you know, ever escape their boundaries. It's about a tenth of a percent. There have been one or two higher profile events that have happened. And sometimes the knee jerk is, okay, we need to ban the use of prescribed fire, which is exactly the opposite thing that we should be doing. If we do that, then we're getting into that situation like we see in other parts of the country where we have systems that are used to being maintained with fire from a natural perspective. Now we're doing it from a man-made perspective. If we withhold that, then we're just building up the fuels like we see out west. So we, you know, if we do ever have an escape that causes, you know, some damage, we absolutely have to learn from, you know, from what happened in that event, but we have to, you know, continue the best practice, which is utilization of fire. And that's just, I know we focused a lot on that. That is a really important part of what, you know, Tall Timbers has done. But it's also, that's an integral component to how we're managing these lands. As I said, we've got 170,000 acres that we've protected at this point. All of those lands are dependent on the use of frequent fire. We've got, you know, some of them, we've got incredible numbers of imperiled species that are imperiled everywhere else. And the last remaining, you know, vestiges of these, they're very healthy populations on these private lands that are using fire as a management tool. So it's absolutely critical that we continue to use that to maintain the lands that Tall Timbers is conserving, both in Florida and in Georgia.
One last thing on fire. So yeah. do some of the private plantation owners, property owners, contract with Tall Timbers to actually do the prescribed burn, or are there private contractors who do that?
There are private contractors that do that. One of the challenges that we have seen is the challenge of the contractors obtaining liability insurance to cover them in the event that an escape happens. And that's something that we've tried to work with the legislature on. We'll continue to try and do that because, like anybody who deals with insurance, you know, all of our rates are going through the roof. The same has been true for burners, certified burners who have been trying to get liability insurance. So we're working on that issue with a number of partners. We don't want that to be an impediment to having that professional expertise out there to help private landowners. A couple of other things we are doing, though, from an organizational perspective, as I said, we've got the National Prescribed Fire Training Center that's based at Tall Timbers. So all those federal folks are being trained there. We also, Tall Timbers hosts three prescribed burn associations. So those are, we help staff those and host those. Those are in Southwest Georgia, Northwest Florida, basically in our Panhandle area, and then in central Alabama. And those are burn associations of private landowners who utilize prescribed fire, but they may need assistance in terms of getting fire on the ground. They may need more expertise. So they turn to those PBAs, prescribed burn associations. They turn to those organizations for help. And it's a great way of those landowners, you know, learning best practices for prescribed fire, so that they can maintain their own properties and then help with their neighbors doing the same thing. So those PBAs are an increasingly important way to kind of help get good fire on the ground.
It's a lot on fire.
What's that?
It's a lot on fire.
It's a lot on fire, yes.
Can we talk about what I've called maybe your second pillar in the conservation area, what Tall Timbers does with respect to land conservation and specifically easements maybe encouraging some of the use of state funds that are available for folks.
Yeah, we We historically have worked in the realm of conservation easements, donated conservation easements. Probably 98 or 99% of the land that we've conserved has been through the donation of conservation easements, typically on, you know, larger tracts of land. And that's just the nature of the Red Hills region that we work in. We're lucky enough to have these very large private landscapes. And those, you know, those owners get a federal tax incentive for doing that. But they also get the peace of mind of knowing that their land is never going to be developed. That's in perpetuity, regardless of if it goes to their relatives or they sell it. And you'd be surprised at the number of landowners who, you know, they've poured their, you know, their heart and soul into managing their property for generations. And the last thing they want is to see anything that would negatively affect, you know, those properties. So they get a peace of mind putting it in a conservation easement. They know it has to be managed in accordance with, you know, with the documents that we establish with them. And of course, we work with them very closely to help manage their help them with management issues on their property, stewardship practices wherever we can. And then on the advocacy side, help them if there are issues out there that, you know, may threaten the conservation interests on their property. I was late getting to the interview today because that's what I was dealing with in Georgia. It was just a policy issue that we need to work on to make sure it doesn't have unintended consequences for some of the conservation lands that we manage. So, and actually, you mentioned, you know, the donated easement side. So that historically has been the focus of Tall Timbers. Increasingly, we're making really great gains just because of the wonderful job that the legislature has done setting aside dollars for conservation in Florida. No other state in the country has a legislature that has supported land conservation like Florida. It's not even close. We would love to see other states do the same thing that Florida has with between our Rural and Family Lands Program and Florida Forever, Florida Communities Trust. There are a number of vehicles that are out there to help, you know, landowners protect their property. There used to be a focus more on the state acquiring those lands and managing them. And then, of course, they realized that, well, that's only half the equation, right? They can conserve it, but then they have to manage it. And, you know, buying land is expensive. Managing it is really expensive because you've now, you know, you've got a perpetual, you know, mandate to manage those lands. So increasingly, we've seen the state very supportive of helping with purchase conservation easements. And Tall Timbers has worked. We've been pretty aggressive working with a number of landowners in the greater Red Hills region on land conservation projects that have been funded through Florida Forever. Hopefully through Rural and Family Lands. There are a lot of dollars in both of those programs right now. And then we also work on the federal side as well with, say, programs like Forest Legacy. So we're trying to kind of broaden, I guess you could say, that toolbox of conservation tools. And of course, these can be used anywhere in Florida. You know, there are, I don't have the number off the top of my head of the number of land trusts in the state, but Florida has a healthy number of land trusts, a good number of accredited land trusts, all of whom, you know, are working in this same realm and are working both on, you know, donated projects, but also on tapping into state and federal resources to help conserve land as well. So kind of the model that we have is unique because of the large landowner base. But the tools that we're using can be used, you know, anywhere for conservation in Florida or other states.
So if a property owner uses either, you know, takes advantage of Florida Forever or Rural and Family Lands Program, what's in, you know, a conservation easement is purchased, what's the requirement to make sure that they're maintaining that property? Yeah. How is that monitored?
Yeah, so of course, when we do private land, when we do donated conservation easements to Tall Timbers, we monitor every one of those properties every year. By law, we have to go at least once a year, but typically, because we do so much stewardship and outreach with our landowners, we're seeing those landowners on a very regular basis to make sure that they're adhering to the conditions of their easement. If you're doing a purchase easement through Florida Forever or Rural and Family Lands, it'll be the same type of situation where there would be an annual monitoring required to make sure that the landowner is adhering to all the regulations and stipulations that are in their negotiated easements with the state of Florida. So the same setup that you would see with an organization like Tall Timbers. I guess, you know, one of the differences I would say, though, is to our benefit is, you know, we've got this 65-year history of working with landowners in the greater Red Hills region. And the phone call I was on before I got here with, you know, one of our landowners was with a landowner and his children to try and figure out how to address an issue that was of concern to them. So we've got this this long multi-generational relationship with our landowner base that I think really kind of helps from a stewardship perspective. They know if they have issues of concern, they can call us, and you know, where it's not the heavy hand sometimes that you might see with, you know, maybe the federal government. It's just a more collaborative relationship. And I think that's something too that the state of Florida is working with as well, recognizing that, you know, they're a partner in these conservation projects and they're a partner in perpetuity. So, you know, I think we're all trying to work on maintaining the best possible relationship that we've got between easement donor and the organization that's managing that donation.
Can we talk a little bit about partnerships? I mean specifically partnerships with like universities and some larger institutions. I think you had mentioned one time that I guess UF IFAS may have interest in a property over in Jefferson County. I couldn't remember what that was. Anyway, just curious about any partnerships with some.
I think part of the reason for an important reason for the success that that Tall Timbers has had is just partnership building. We partner with federal partners, state partners, local partners, NGOs, you name it. It's pretty rare for us to get involved in an advocacy issue where we aren't reaching out and trying to cultivate as many relationships as possible. If you think about something like our Regional Conservation Partnership Program, that is a federal grant that Tall Timbers has. It's through the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Natural Resource Conservation Service. I'm going to pat myself on the back for not using acronyms. So we have that Regional Conservation Partnership Program grant. It's called an RCPP. And that is an opportunity for an organization like Tall Timbers or other land trusts. The Alachua ACT, Alachua Conservation Trust, has an RCPP grant as well. That's an opportunity to do more creative conservation than typically you would see from maybe the NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service. And the focus of those RCPP projects is partnership building. It's working with partners that you normally might not work with on a conservation project. So I think we've got about 10 or 12 federal, state, and local partners and NGOs that are involved in our project on the Ocilla River watershed. And that's an effort on both the Ocilla River in Florida, which is an outstanding Florida waterway, and the St. Marks River as well, to conserve land that's in that floodplain. And we're working, I guess one of the things I like most about that is typically we work with very large landowners, but that Ocilla River and St. Mark's RCPP project has opened the door to landowners who had much smaller land holdings, but land holdings that are still important for protecting that watershed. So we're working with a large number of landowners, some who have, you know, 7 acres and 10 acres and 15 acres, all the way up to 7,000 acres of land. And it is a very complex project, but it's also very flexible. So we're working on conservation, trying to protect those landscapes. We're working on stewardship, helping them with maybe converting lands that have been in lines of pines in commercial agriculture and turning those into maybe longleaf pine stands. I think last year we planted about 600,000 trees on some of those properties in conjunction with those landowners. We're helping them control exotics on their property and just kind of convert some of those landscapes into more of a naturally maintained landscape, more native plants, trees, et cetera. And then importantly, of course, going back to fire, a number of these properties are lands that have not had fire on them for a long time for a variety of reasons. So that RCPP project is is helping us bring fire back to those landscapes too. So it's kind of, it's everything from soup to nuts in terms of doing really good management across the spectrum of large, medium, and small size properties. So conserving them, and then helping steward those properties, and of course educating those landowners so that they can kind of take on those activities moving forward. That's a really great example of kind of the kind of partnership programs that we're trying to engage in.
So that RCPP, is that something that Tall Timbers manages? Is that
so yours? Yeah, it's a federal funding through the Department of Agriculture, then through the Natural Resource Conservation Service. Tall Timbers was the grant recipient. I think we're in about our third year on that project. We've got a staff that works specifically on that RCPP project. That's also both in Florida and Georgia. So we're doing land conservation across both states. You know, you got this imaginary line on the map. Oh, here's Florida, here's Georgia. Well, the river doesn't really respect that line, right? Nor does, you know, the habitat. So we're working across that state line into Georgia and working on all those stewardship issues as well as conservation issues. So it has a lot of promise. It's somewhat of a new program, so you know there's still some bugs to be worked out, but it is funded through the Farm Bill. And I just got back from Washington, and that was part of the advocacy that we were doing up there was continuation of RCPP for the because of the promise of the program, but also, you know, trying to kind of fix some of the glitches, iron out some of the glitches in how that those programs are administered from the federal level to the state level and then down to landowners on the ground.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Let's talk about, because you're a planner. You went to planning school. You got
I must be a planner.
You got a graduate degree in planning. Tell us about some of the smart growth and planning and advocacy that you guys are doing. If you look at your website, which I did, it talked about a lot about the smart growth. I mean, how does that fit into the broader picture of what you're doing at Tall Timbers?
You know, as an example, like in Tallahassee, you know, where we are now, Tall Timbers, even before we had a planning and advocacy program, you know, worked on the creation of the first blueprint initiative going back into the late 80s and early 90s, which was an initiative to, you know, fund gray infrastructure, but also green infrastructure, and to design places for people and places that we want to kind of set aside as well. So we've had a long history of doing that kind of work. We stepped it up, obviously, about 20 years ago, 22 years ago, when I got to Tall Timbers. And like with everything else, we're trying to have really solid collaborative relationships with our cities and our counties. I work pretty closely in conjunction with the City County Planning Department here, Tallahassee, Leon County. One of the most important issues for us is the urban service boundary. We've got a urban service area around Tallahassee that basically is where we're trying to encourage growth. Outside of that urban service area, we're trying to discourage growth. And kind of our component of that is, you know, what can we do to have smarter infill development? We know one size doesn't fit all. Not everybody wants to live, you know, in a high rise or, you know, in a duplex or triplex. They might want to live in a house in a big lot, and that's fine. But we need to have a whole range of options for those folks. And we need to try and do a better job of kind of steering our growth onto existing infrastructure. You know, one of the issues that we always see is just, you know, no local government ever says, God, we've got all the money in the world. We can do everything we want, you know. It's more a case of how on God's earth are we going to, you know, pave the streets and, you know, keep up with the maintenance on our wastewater treatment plant and all of those kinds of things. So we know we do a lot better when we build on existing infrastructure and when we maximize existing infrastructure as opposed to kind of putting it all over the place and having to continue to raise taxes to support that. So developing inside those urban service areas in our local community, but of course in communities around the state of Florida and Georgia is vital as well. And to kind of reinforce that, that's kind of where our land conservation comes in. So if you, you know, look at a map at the planning department, you know, you'll see a lot of green on the map north of Tallahassee, northeast of Tallahassee, and most of that are lands that have been permanently protected. So those are lands that are, you know, conservation lands, a lot of them to Tall Timbers, and that kind of helps to balance that more intensive growth that we see inside the urban service areas.
So do you ever Does Tall Timbers ever comment on some planning amendments, land use amendments?
Yes.
Yeah. Have you ever intervened on?
We do a lot of education. We'll meet with city commissioners. It's usually county commissioners because of the more rural nature. But we routinely will talk to county commissioners and planning staff, and of course the private sector and developers and homeowners and everybody else. You kind of have to work with all the different parties to try and address either comprehensive plan amendments or maybe development proposals. I will say we're very lucky because Tallahassee-Leon County is very different. Bruce Babbitt wrote a book probably 30 years ago called, I believe, Cities in the Wilderness. And he was the former Secretary of the Interior. And he focused on 10 or 15 communities around the country that were just doing things a little different, right? And were more successful than others in terms of having places for people and places conserved for wildlife, right? And Tallahassee was one of the places he focused on because of its location, just north of a national forest, just north of a wildlife refuge, St. Mark's Wildlife Refuge, and just south of all the privately preserved lands in the Red Hills. And he kind of highlighted that as kind of an interesting opportunity for a city to live, in harmony, basically, with conserved lands all around it. So we're very lucky, and we recognize that. But yeah, we've had, opportunities to comment on comp plan amendments and try and address, those concerns. And the same is true for, larger projects, infrastructure projects. That's probably one of the biggest issues we deal with. It's much less on comprehensive plan amendments. It's mostly things like the MCORS toll road proposal, which was, a proposal for 300 plus miles of toll roads from the 2019 legislature, I believe. One of those projects, the Suncoast Connector, would have gone through a number of our conservation easements. So that was obviously a project that we advocated. We played a role in advocating against that particular component. Again, we thought there was some merit to obviously the roadway improvements, but the way they were proposed was kind of a sledgehammer kind of approach. So yeah, that's issues like that. We'll try and play a collaborative role to try and bring resolution to an issue.
From an administrative standpoint, I mean, do you see an advantage of having a joint county-city planning department? I know they have separate growth management departments, but...
Yeah, I really do. I really do. It's, when we have these artificial boundaries, not that that's an artificial boundary, but when we are kind of siloed out, even if, you're in the same building and on the same floor, it's just more challenging to deal with some of these issues that are completely interrelated. I have enormous respect for the professionals that we work with at the planning department. I'm in pretty close contact with them because, again, now we've gotten to the stage where with 170,000 acres, not all of that is in, the Red Hills. Some of that is in our other focal areas too, but we have a large footprint in terms of conservation land, so that does affect where growth can occur and vice versa. So we just find it's good to be in collaboration with those partners. But yeah, if those cities and counties have a combined planning department or growth management department, that's just, I think it's more effective for how they manage growth, and it's easier for people in the community to utilize that resource, be they a developer or, HOA, homeowner association, or even just, just a member of the public.
I'm going to wrap things up because we've been in here for 45 minutes.
I did not know that.
Oh. And I've got a post-millennial intern who's going to be doing the editing, so we can pause and giggle and laugh, and he edits next door. But
okay.
What about can you talk about the role of county officials in some of the work that you do? Because you were talking about partnerships, and I got to believe they've got to be a partner in this, but can you just talk about the role of specifically county officials and, maybe something that they can walk away with that you think is important for the mission of Tall Timbers?
Absolutely crucial. I try and have, relationships with professional relationships with all of our county commissioners. As I said, city commissioners a little less so, just because of the geography of what we're dealing with. But we've got several county commissioners whose districts, you know, include lands that that Tall Timbers works on. We try and get all of those commissioners out to see those properties. A lot of them have been through Leadership Tallahassee, so they've visited Tall Timbers because we're one of the stops on Leadership Tallahassee. Some of them have been there, through Florida Association of Counties or Leadership Florida. But we want them to be very familiar with what we're doing from a conservation perspective, and just kind of educate them on that aspect of things, but also from a growth management perspective. Again, we are far from an anti-growth organization. We have somewhat of a conservative board, a lot of business folks on that board, and that's just not something they would tolerate. But they do understand the difference between good growth and then growth kind of willy-nilly spread all over the place. That's not, fiscally efficient. So we try and have those really close relationships, and I count some of my best relationships those that I have with our county commissioners in Leon County. So they're integral in terms of kind of them educating us about issues, but also, vice versa. And there's kind of a lot of sharing of ideas and just brainstorming on issues. And I in all honesty, I can say this with 100% honesty, I couldn't ask for better relationships with those commissioners that we're working with that overlap in terms of from a geographical perspective with what Tall Timbers is doing. There's also kind of almost an increasing relationship too, because as we kind of move beyond donated easements with our landowner base to potentially some Florida Forever projects or rural and family lands projects, those kind of projects, it really helps to have a supportive, county commissioner or county commission. And to their credit, whenever we've approached a commissioner about, would you consider supporting this project, every single time, they have. And of course, we'll bring them out to those properties to, to show them, what we're trying to conserve. And they've just been a pleasure to work with and key to what we're trying to do from a conservation perspective.
Well, I mean, it's not hyperbole to say, what you do out there is just blowing me away. I mean, I don't know why I had not reached out to you before and, either gone jogging or something out there, but it's really amazing what you guys are doing out there. And as a recovering planner, I'm always interested in these kind of things. So
one thing I'd encourage, folks to do, county commissioners, county administrators, et cetera. We obviously focus here in the Red Hills region, Northwest Florida, Southwest Georgia. But, we do have, more than a dozen land conservancies around the state, and a number of them are accredited land trusts. And they like Tall Timbers, they meet the highest level of standards of regulations from a land trust perspective. And I would encourage, elected officials and appointed officials just to try and find out which land conservancies are working in their backyard, because those are great advocates in terms of, protecting land just for natural resource sake, for wildlife sake. But a number of those also work on, public access issues as well. So there are a number of land trusts that are around the state, and I would just encourage folks to reach out to them and partner with them whenever they can.
Awesome. Neil, thank you very much for coming in Studio 67 and being our latest edition of County Conversations Podcast.
It was a pleasure. Happy to.
All right. Thank you.
Yep.